Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Daily Objective. Today, I've got Mark with me. How's it going, Mark?
Hanging in there, man. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I'm dying of the plague, as I was just saying, but I'll pull through. So today, we're talking about one of these reoccurring monsters that keep coming up during this conflict. It's a Hydra. No matter how many times we address it, it grows a new head. And this is Ireland, and this is the UN. And in particular, there have been some comments made by the Irish president, a guy called Michael Higgins, I believe, that there is a propaganda campaign being waged against the UN, and he's urged fellow Western sort of G7 nations to resume funding for UNRWA in particular. And I think there's a lot to say about this. But Mark, what was your impressions of this story, either about the UN or what have you thought about Ireland and its response to the war in Gaza in recent months?
Well, I don't think the UN needs propaganda to mobilize a public opinion against it. Its own record stands for itself. It's a fairly ridiculous organization, as any organization that attempts to marry incompatible government ideologies together in some form of peaceful alliance would be. But even more distressing to me is the amount of anti-Semitism I see in Ireland. When I first came out for Israel in 2014, after Israel responded to the kidnapping and murder of three of its citizens, the predominant wave of anti-Semitism on social media was coming out of Ireland, and it shocked me because I found that country to be one beautiful, physically beautiful, and my experience with the people there was fairly phenomenal. So I was surprised to see such a deep undercurrent of racism and bigotry out of that country. Now, I think they do it because they erroneously equate the Irish cause with the Palestinian cause, like many gay people out here equate oppressions, and they think they're all equal and that they share something so common that they should support one another, irrespective of the details. But yeah, this guy Higgins has his head up his warm, dark place, and unfortunately, I'm not surprised from everything I've heard coming out of Ireland.
Yeah, it is. I agree. There's a kind of disappointment about the Irish response. Everyone I've ever met from Ireland has been immensely friendly, and there's even as a country, although they struggle around abortion and things like that. There are certain things about the Irish economy, like Ireland for a long time has been one of the freest economies in the world. Things which might lead you to believe positive things about Ireland, and yet their whole attitude towards Israel and the war in Gaza is just utterly deplorable. And the Irish Prime Minister is even worse than this guy, right? But for him, so this idea of it being propaganda, this is something that comes up, I think, quite frequently when you get two sides in a conflict or a dispute. And I think it's just a smear tactic, really, because what he's actually criticizing the campaign against the UN and a war against UNRWA, because he's quoting Philippe Lazzarini when he's talking about the campaign. Yeah, there's a lot of vocal criticism, and I think for a lot of very good reasons, based in evidence and based on a principle of justice. And it isn't right to call that propaganda. Propaganda, if you think about Joseph Goebbels in Nazi Germany, the minister of propaganda was about spinning the truth or telling outright lies in a way to indoctrinate the public. And for him to say that the criticism of UNRWA or the UN is propaganda is just a like a low smear tactic, isn't it?
Of course, and if something's propaganda, you don't have to address whether the assertions are true or false. Just like when you call somebody a racist, you don't have to consider any of their arguments anymore. I don't know if this is new. I'm sure people have been doing this forever. We're just more acquainted with it because social media puts it in our face. But this is just the way people disengage their minds and promote their agenda. Look, I mean, Gaza should be getting not 1 cent from anybody in the United Nations. From any free state should boycott sending money to the UN, because we all know where it goes. And even if it didn't go to Hamas terrorists funding them, feeding them, supporting their activities, it goes to a complicitous population who should not benefit in any way from committing an act of war against a peaceful neighbor.
Yeah, and his so and the kind of way he rounds off his statement is to appeal to kind of, I think, soft sort of hazy, fuzzy sentiments that are basically just designed to appeal to people's emotions in order to get them on side. He says things about we should remember our common humanity and all this kind of stuff, right? And it isn't like c the idea of common humanity could never be appealed to or something like that. But all of this kind of stuff just seems to me to be designed to completely circumvent the idea of justice, because particularly whilst he's voicing a defense of the UN, he's particularly referencing UNRWA, as I said. And from all that we know about UNRWA, I've known about UNRWA for years, but particularly if we just think about in the recent conflict, the evidence about the UNRWA teacher who kept one of the hostages in his attic, the UNRWA teacher who dragged the corpse off the road and put it into the back of his truck with someone else, the UNRWA Telegram chat that was unveiled by Eitan Fischberger and was reported on by the UN Watch, where these people celebrated October 7th. UNRWA is rotten to the core, or the data center that was beneath their headquarters. UNRWA is completely rotten all the way down. And for Rand, and so from our point of view, it's really important to identify something accurately and to treat it accordingly. And if you don't, if you allow yourself to be overcome by kind of warm, fuzzy emotions, and then to treat it as if it's something that it's not, then that is, the essence of injustice. And that's what so many of these people end up appealing to, I think. They and maybe to a kind of soft Christian kind of hangover in our culture, where you can appeal to that kind of stuff. And I think it's completely designed to subvert real justice here. And I think we can't let up on that at all.
Well, I agree. First of all, I mean, look, humanity isn't a physical property. It's not something that every human being carries with him. To me, humanity means something. It means a fully operational rational consciousness, and what we share in common is values, primarily the value of reason. That's our common humanity. And if somebody does not exercise that, which is completely voluntary, your humanity is voluntary, then we have no common humanity. And we have nothing to share. We have nothing in common. The people of Gaza decided to commit an act of war. They decided to throw humanity aside and assert savagery on another people. Okay, so there's no commonality there. There's only the only thing that the defending people can do is defend themselves against this threat until it's over. There is no common humanity until the other side gives up and renounces violence, embraces again the thing that makes us human: reason, rational negotiation, persuasion. That's what makes that's our common our humanity.
I think you hit on something really right as well when you were talking about how it seems like people in Ireland identify the kind of the cause of the Palestinians or the Gazans with their kind of with the cause of Irish history, in effect, and Irish independence. And I think that's even wider than Ireland. So, I live in Scotland. And for the kind of, I guess you'd say, formerly Celtic nations, what however you want to put it, so Scotland, Wales, Ireland, there's a huge kind of strain of thought which has really taken hold and which never used to be there. People act as if that's been continuous all the time. And in Ireland, I think it does have a much deeper history. If you go and look at Daniel O'Connell in the 19th century, who isn't, an evil figure, but there's a much longer history of a desire for independence and viewing themselves as oppressed and colonialized by the British. But for Scotland and for Wales, this sentiment was very much not there, and was they're actually very loyal in a sense to the idea of the UK. And in the 20th century, there were these conscious efforts by intellectuals in the universities here, particularly in the humanities departments, and so to revive the idea of a independent Scottish identity and to revive the speaking of the local languages. Now, the languages never died out, but there was a conscious effort to revive them and to embrace a distinct Scottish identity and forms of Scottish dress and so on. And that does have a precedent in the 19th century as well, but it didn't have the same orientation. And so people in Scotland, when they argue for independence, they will very readily tell you about how they've been colonized, their culture has been repressed, and so on. And there are aspects of that in the very early interactions between England and Scotland when they were at war, or they might refer to things like the Highland Clearances back in the 1740s. But where Scottish dancing was outlawed for a time under George the Third. And you know, who likes George the Third? Clearly not the Americans, right? But not anybody. So it's not like there isn't some of those things there, but they have to really reach for it. And this kind of thinking, I think, is just corrosive to people's souls and to people's minds. And it ends up lending them, causing them to have sympathy for these kind of causes. And so there is a lot more sympathy for Gaza and the Palestinians here in Scotland than there is south of the border in England. And I think it's just an utter brain rot. And unfortunately, I don't see how it's going to be overturned because the momentum is completely with them. But I dearly hope that it is.
Yeah, I
And
mean, I feel like we're revisiting the early 20th century, early and mid 20th century again. I'm not sure why intellectuals are enamored of tribalism. They certainly seem to be. My only guess, the guess I would hazard, I don't know if it's been hazarded before, is that they feel alienated, and the only thing that makes them feel anchored to reality and meaning is some form of group identity, and that's why they keep promoting this stuff for decades upon decades upon decades. But what's the result of it? Well, the hyper-nationalism of the early 20th century led to World War I, and that continued on into World War II. And it's more or less leading to social division today, where people divide themselves up into little communities, little tribes of people that have grievances, and then essentially are at war with the community at large. And that's what we're seeing today, a state of constant conflict.
yeah. Well, and then in the UK, they constantly are trying to dis split up the country. But no, I agree with the tribalism point. And what's odd about these people who view themselves as so pro Palestine, and the Palestinians, if they achieve, you know, a fully independent Palestinian state, it will resemble what Hamas has done in Gaza. It will be an authoritarian, you know, Islamic state where people are not free. And yet these people of the kind of Celtic nations and so on, so like Ireland, very much view themselves as being of the left and yet have this strong nationalistic streak running through them as well, which I think actually, if you challenge them on it, they find it quite hard to explain. Certainly, they do here in Scotland. The Scottish National Party that's in government views itself as being a socialist left party. And then when they're challenged on the nationalism point, maybe you don't want to combine socialism with nationalism. It's not like that's always had a good history. They get very squeamish and they don't like to answer that. But so, I mean, and just for some more context for people, if they hadn't seen some of the previous shows on Ireland. So, Ireland announced that it was resuming its funding of UNRWA after the initial swathe of the withdrawal of funding by pretty much all of its principal funders. So, they resumed funding of about 20 million euros. And then, with the president calling on countries to resume funding, unfortunately, whilst it might not be solely down to him, this kind of slow ebbing away of the sense of outrage about what UNRWA has done has led to some other countries resuming funding as well. So Canada announced that it was going to be resuming funding as well. The European Commission was giving something about, I think, 50 million euros. Sweden was giving $19 million. Now, fortunately, the head of UNRWA is saying that they still might go bust. So they seem to be real spenders over there. I don't know how they can't keep their operation going, but thankfully not, and they might go under. But I want to really focus on this idea of justice because I think people are uncomfortable with it. That if you act in this way, you do not deserve the tax money of free Western nations to continue funding the indoctrination and oppression of children in Gaza and the perpetuation of a racist conflict in against Israel. And if I think maybe a way we could win the kind of communications battle, it's if we can convince people that that's what it is, because I think they don't see that as what it is, because everyone views themselves as against racism except for the, you know, the really awful fringe. And if we can get people to understand that what UNRWA is doing is indoctrinating its children into racism, then maybe we can convince them. Do you think that's credible, or is it sort of a lost cause?
I think it's incredible now because there's a phenomenon called anti-racism, which has cropped up, which is actually racism. It's the practice and implementation of racism by the people at the other side of the oppression hierarchy in order to gain power and status. When you look at the profiles, the social media profiles of all the people who are pro-Palestinian, 99% of them are socialists. And so I get the sense that their cause is deeper. Like they have a resentment for capitalism, property ownership, independence. They hate those in general. They think those are the monsters that have caused every injustice in the West. And that's what their war is actually against. And the means that they're using to wage war is chaos, or taking advantage of exploiting situations that for most people are morally gray grounds that are difficult them to ask for them to ascertain who the good and who the bad is. And they also use paradoxes and contradictions in our own values against us in an attempt to demoralize us and come throw out the whole because parts are corrupt. So I see this as a from a larger perspective of the people who mostly support the Palestinians are not supporting them because their cause is just. They're supporting them because they hate the West and they want to overturn the West, and this is just the new means to do it. If it wasn't this, then it would be some form of some identity politics. However you can divide people and get them in conflict, sow chaos, that's their bag.
So I'll just read out a few of the super chats. So we have $3 from Catherine. Thank you, Catherine. $1 from Bonnie. Thank you, Bonnie. £1 from Apollo Zeus. And $3 from Enric Teller. Thank you very much. And then $10 from Ginger Clark, who says, I don't believe it's alienation. I think tribalism springs from pure laziness, their unwillingness or perhaps inability to think for oneself. I think that's kind of what you said. Would you agree?
I think that's true, but I'm trying to get at the motivation for intellectuals. Intellectuals, I think, and a lot of intellectuals look at themselves as passive. It's difficult for them to see themselves as influencing the world or building any value in the world. And most intellectuals are right from a perspective of alienation. They're on the outside critiquing what's going on in the inside. And they critique it precisely because it's a group they want to belong to but can't seem to find the admission ticket to. So they critique it instead, like angry high schoolers who can't go to the dance with the girl they want to or be in the in-group that they want to be in. And then it becomes a thing, and then they build an intellectual career out of that kind of critique, at which point it becomes extremely difficult to withdraw yourself or reverse your position because you've built an entire career on it. So, I mean, and they're insecure. I mean, most of these intellectuals are insecure. They feel alienated, and they're looking for something, anything to ground them, to make them feel like they belong, to make them feel important. Don't underestimate the drive of even fake self-esteem for, in just about everything someone does. Recognition is important to these guys. Feeling like they belong is important to these guys. Just look at the Academy Awards for crying out loud. Look at the guy who took the acceptance speech for Zones of Interest, one of the most amazing films of the year. He went up there and pandered to the crowd. He pandered to the crowd. It's my impression that he was probably insecure about making a movie about the horrors of Auschwitz and the evasion of the German people, and he didn't want to be the odd man out in a room full of people who hold a different opinion. So he wanted to be in the gang.
Yeah. And I mean, as well, I mean, we spoke about this on the show. They were wearing those little red hand pins. And I mean, if you were there, what would you have done if you saw them doing that? Would you have said something to them, or would you have just brushed them off, do you think?
Well, there's nothing to say to them on the red carpet. I mean, there's really nothing to say to them. You're there to promote your work. I would proudly wear, probably an Israeli flag on my lapel to show my support, since people are making political commitments there. And if somebody asked me about it in an interview, I'd say why I supported them, and I'd make my case as best as I could. And if I won the award, if I felt it was appropriate to say something, I would. If not, I'd say give my thanks and walk off the stage. I tend to not think that award ceremonies are the place to make political statements, and likely wouldn't, but I'd certainly try to be a counterweight to the craziness there.
Yeah. And on the point about intellectuals and academics, if anyone's never read The Fountainhead, Ellsworth Tui is a really great portrait of that kind of mentality. He's a bit more self-aware. than I think some of these people are, because I think they have to really hide their rottenness from themselves. But he's a good portrait for, I think, what that kind of thing you're talking about, Mark.
Yeah, I don't think an Ellsworth Tui could really live in life knowing what they're doing, right? It feels like most people, even on that level, like a Paul Krugman, I think is an Ellsworth Tui type. They can't admit to themselves that they really just like being at the cool table, and invited to all the right cocktail parties and seen by all the right people. They don't even know that they're more like Peter Keatings with brains. They don't know why they're doing what they're doing, most of them.
Yeah, well, I was reading an essay collection by Chomsky and Ilan Pappe, which they published in 2015 about Palestine. And what was interesting was the first essay in it, Ilan Pappe is talking about how he thinks we should develop a new language for talking about Israel as compared to the old language. So he thinks the old peace movement language about a two-state solution and the peace process and so on, that's like too compromising. It's not good enough. So he's arguing that we have to start pushing, and he's from his side, should push the idea of apartheid and genocide and boycott, divestment, sanctions. And it was a prophetic essay to read, because that's exactly what you've seen and what we've
Yeah.
seen come around. And he probably gets a bit of a kick out of seeing that having had its influence. And I think that is what these people are like. And Rand in For the New Intellectual talks about the mystics of spirit and the mystics of muscle. And so the mystics of spirit is the kind of, the witch doctory type who would be filled in by the modern academic. And the mystic of muscle would be the modern politician. So like this Irish president kind of guy, who is the flip side of the coin and presumably gets some kind of pseudo self-esteem for pursuing his own vicious, version of this cause, and by subverting justice the whole time. And I agree. And like the academics kind of have to lie to themselves, like we were saying. I think that whole stuff he's bringing up at the end about our common humanity and all this kind of stuff, I think, if they can say to themselves that they really believe in a kind of humanitarianism, a kind of, warm, positive feeling towards other people, then they can really hide that what they're supporting is the indoctrination of children in UNRWA, and that they're giving loads of money to do that, to turn them into vicious killers and racists, and a cause which is designed to wipe the only Jewish nation off the face of the earth and kill all the people who are there. And because how could you live with yourself once you've acknowledged that? Even I think, I mean, part of what Zone of Interest, I guess, is about, I've heard my partner's reading the book. I haven't watched it or read it, but it seems to be that it's the kind of banality of evil idea. And in part of that seems to be the idea that even some of the Nazis couldn't really admit to themselves what exactly they were doing. They had to sort of blank it out.
I mean, that's why I think objectivism is right on in pinning evasion as like one of the worst sins of humanity, because that's exactly what that entire family does. You haven't seen the movie?
No, not yet. I'm going to them. Yeah.
It's terrifying. I mean, it's literally the days in the life of this family of the commandant, commander of Auschwitz, who lives right on the other side of the wall from Auschwitz, and how divorced they are mentally and emotionally and spiritually from what's going on the other side, because you hear people screaming in the background. Auschwitz is always in the background, shots fired, echoed through, and every once in a while a family member will look out the window and see something terrifying and then shut the shades. So the whole idea is that these people are evading a massive reality, and the wife is doing it because she likes the home. It's a big, she's had an ambition to live in a big house with all the amenities, and well, she got it. And in fact, there's a point at which the commandant is transferred to Berlin, and she doesn't want to leave the house. She wants to stay in Auschwitz-Birkenau, right next door to mass murder. It's
Yeah.
a very haunting film. It's a very haunting film. I recommend that you see it, because it does the theme to me is evasion. I don't know if it's the banality of evil. It's definitely that's definitely a part of it, but how evil evasion is.
Yeah, Molly's reading it at the moment, and she says the book's excellent. So I want to see the film, but I'm definitely going to read it. I mean, and what you said there sounds perhaps more like a more extreme version of The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, where, do you remember, there's that scene where the wife is sort of somehow ignorant of what's going on in the concentration camp, and then I think the ash from the where they burn the bodies is coming up, and one of the guards sort of callously remarks, like, they stink, don't they? And she realizes, like, what's going on, and now she's appalled. But presumably, in this film, it's that they evade that their feeling there, that they're appalled by it.
In Zone of Interest.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I certainly don't think the parents even are, they evade. They have other interests. The man engages in his job and he wants to do his job perfectly, which is to exterminate Jews. And the wife wants to be a homemaker, and that's all that, you know, they're just literally ground down to the perceptual moment. It's not about the human far vision way of looking at life.
Yeah. And for these Irish politicians or the politicians in the UN, they're evading as well. We did, I think it was on the reality show yesterday, we covered a video that was released by Barry Weiss, where she was interviewing Palestinians in the West Bank, all of whom said that they supported October 7th. One guy says, when he's asked about how many people support it, he says 70% openly support it and 30% support it but are quiet about it. And she asks, which are you? And he says, I'm 101%. It's just this vile, awful video. And where one of the women says, look, I'm against all killing, but there has to be an action taken. And I felt on October 7th about Hamas, look, here's someone who's going to protect me. So the people in Ireland, or these Irish politicians, or in the UN, are completely having to evade the situation that's going on here and the fight that Israel's having to fight. Otherwise, you couldn't, in any good conscience, maintain this, well, what is a, you could say is a propaganda war against Israel, if you want to use that language. And
Exactly
we,
what it is.
yeah.
And what's more important to Higgins, to politicians like Higgins, is, you know, the sentimental nod from the audience member. That means more to him than being on the side of right, because being on the side of right is extremely uncomfortable.
Well,
Because
at least.
if it's unpopular, especially if it's unpopular, which it usually is.
Yeah, well, and it's at least going to take some courage from people. And what is so often lacking amongst our politicians, certainly, is courage. When you see that there was an immense amount of support for Israel that ebbed away over time, that is just a sign of how much courage they lack. And it's a sign of how much courage they need to gain. And yet, unfortunately, I don't think they're going to do that anytime soon. But okay, we've only got 2 minutes left for the reality show. So we'll wrap up. We're talking about a young man who's been granted asylum in the UK on the grounds that he would suffer racist apartheid in Israel. So we're going to talk about more lovely things done by my country. And I hope everyone comes over and joins us. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
And we'll see everyone again tomorrow on the Daily Objective. Bye bye.
Peace.